You know, I think we've all been trapped in a system that's designed to measure us.
Oh, absolutely.
And it often has these disastrous, totally counterproductive results.
Right.
Just think about that feeling of being measured, whether it's, I don't know, steps walked, calories consumed, or if you work in an office, something like keystrokes per hour.
It's this constant surveillance of efficiency. And it often creates this weird tension where your goal is no longer to do good work, but to, perform for the tracker.
Exactly. I was reading about this woman, Dana. Her company brought in this new productivity system that measured everything.
Everything, like what?
Time spent active in an application, response time on chat, even the number of clicks, and Dana's score, her official productivity metric, it just skyrocketed.
Okay, so she was getting bonuses, praise,
All of it.
but I'm guessing her actual value to the company just plummeted.
Completely. Her strategy wasn't better work, it was just pure optimization. She would instantly reply to emails with a single word.
Just to clock a fast response time.
Exactly. And she'd constantly switch between spreadsheets and documents just to keep her time and application score high, which meant she couldn't actually commit to the deep, thoughtful work that required focus.
So she was celebrated for getting really good at the measurement game, and because of that, she got worse at her actual job.
Right.
That anecdote, it just perfectly encapsulates the mechanism we're diving into today. This is the core principle that causes systems to fail, I mean, across all fields.
So today we are doing a deep dive into Goodhart's Law.
And it's a deceptively simple idea. It was first articulated by an economist, and it goes, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
The moment you incentivize a number, people stop aiming for the complex goal and start aiming only for the number.
It sounds so obvious when you say it like that, but this is the mechanism that hollows out quality education, that degrades our health care, and undermines public safety.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, you want to improve education, so you measure standardized test scores. The moment you tie funding to those scores, people stop teaching the subject matter and they start optimizing for the score itself.
So this isn't just some cute theory. It's the blueprint for how complex qualitative systems get destroyed by simple quantitative metrics.
Exactly.
Our mission today is to understand why we keep prioritizing these measurable proxies over our true complex goals and how that short-sighted optimization ends up breaking the very things we are trying to fix.
Okay, so to really get this, let's start with its purest, most absurd form. It's an old one, but it just perfectly illustrates a rational response to a flawed metric.
Oh, I know where you're going. The Soviet nail factory.
The Soviet nail factory. So central planners, they needed a way to measure the output of their heavy industry, right? They needed a metric for success.
And they started simple,
Yeah.
the number of nails produced.
And what happens? The factory manager, who's under all this pressure, does the only rational thing. He makes millions of these tiny, almost weightless nails.
The counter goes way up. He hits his target.
He's his target. But were they useful? Of course not. You can't build a barn with a million tiny tacks.
So the planners, they look at this result, this huge quantity of useless output, and they course correct. They change the metric to the weight of nails produced. Logic would suggest this fixes the problem.
And the factory manager reacts rationally again. All of a sudden, the factory is only producing a few massive, heavy spikes, maybe five nails that each weigh a ton.
And again, the factory meets its quota with flying colors.
But again, they're useless for construction. The initial goal producing a variety of nails that the economy actually needs was just obliterated.
That story is just key because it shows the gap between, measurability and actual value.
A huge gap.
Weight and quantity, they're absolutely relevant to nail production, but no single metric, not even two, can capture the complex qualitative concept of useful output.
The moment you make any one metric the boss, the system starts serving the boss, not the customer.
Which really begs the question, why do we keep doing this? Why do we even use proxies in the first place?
Well, the research from people like Amara Thompson suggests it's because the actual goals, things like provide citizens with wisdom and critical thinking or ensure holistic patient health, they're complex. They're often inherently unmeasurable.
And people, especially administrators, get deeply uncomfortable with things they can't measure.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So we substitute those messy qualitative goals with clean, measurable proxies, test scores, patient throughput, response times.
And these proxies give the illusion of control and objectivity.
Illusion of control is the perfect phrase. We tell ourselves we can manage what we measure.
Right.
And once we use that proxy, the entire system, the funding, the promotions, job security, it all focuses its energy on optimizing that proxy. And the underlying goal, it just starts to decay.
And people who suggest, oh, let's just add more metrics.
That just makes the game more complicated. People are smart. They will just optimize whichever metric has the strongest incentive and often destroy the others in the process.
So it seems like the only real solution outside of measurement is what? Qualitative judgment. By experts who understand the whole system.
It is. But the modern world just refuses to scale systems based on human judgment.
Which brings us to a really fascinating modern example of this, of outsourcing that judgment to technology.
Yes. The high-tech sorting robots used in municipal recycling programs.
This is a perfect modern Goodhart trap. The cities want to maximize the amount of usable, high-quality, recycled material. So the metric they used for the new robots was straightforward sorting accuracy.
And on a technical level, they totally won. These robots, with machine vision, can get 99% purity sorting paper from plastic. Way better than a human.
But Marcus Chen, who analyzed the actual outcomes, he noted a major systemic failure.
Right.
While contamination at the sorting facility dropped to near zero, the total capture rate, so the overall amount of recyclable material actually getting back into the supply chain, it dropped by 15%.
How is that possible? How could superior sorting technology reduce the amount of material captured?
Because the system outsourced judgment to the machine. Before the robots, cities ran campaigns telling citizens, rinse your jars, don't bag your plastics. People knew their effort was essential.
Right.
Once the robots were installed and marketed as this ultimate solution, citizens,
yeah.
They just stopped being active participants.
They relaxed. They thought, oh, the robot can sort at 99%, so I don't need to rinse my milk carton or take out that plastic baggie.
Exactly. They became passive consumers. So the influx of all these marginally contaminated items, greasy cardboard, bottles still full of liquid. It didn't confuse the robot, but that contamination ruined the entire bales earlier in the process.
During collection and transport.
Right. So optimizing one single node, the sorting accuracy, it broke the entire upstream flow and reduced the global utility of the whole system.
It shows that when you optimize one part, you often do it at the expense of necessary human effort and cognition throughout the rest of the system.
Let's turn to a much darker, much higher stakes example, policing and harm reduction. Starting in the 90s, police departments adopted less lethal weapons, you know, tasers, beanbag guns. The goal was admirable, reduce police shootings and fatalities.
And the metric they incentivized was simple. Deploy a less lethal option instead of a firearm.
On paper, it's a clear trade-off. You replace a lethal option with a non-lethal one, harm should go down.
But the outcome, when you look at the analysis from researchers like Jennifer Hartwell, was complex and devastating, while firearm usage in specific situations might have shifted slightly.
The overall use of force increased dramatically. And in a lot of places, the total death rate in police encounters didn't decrease. Sometimes it even went up.
So what was the failure there? It's behavioral.
Completely behavioral. The very presence of a less lethal option changed the officer's internal calculus for using force at all.
I see. So before the taser, if an officer faced an agitated person who wasn't an immediate lethal threat, the options were what? Talking, physical restraint, or shooting?
And the choice usually defaulted to de-escalation because the consequences of the other options were so incredibly high.
But the taser, it's perceived as this low-consequence intermediate option. So it lowers the threshold for using force at all.
Exactly. Officers started using the weapon in situations where they would have previously just used verbal skills and patience.
They shifted from de-escalation to rapid deployment.
And the consequences were severe. Taser use can cause deaths, especially for people with underlying heart conditions or if it's used repeatedly. So by optimizing the metric, using the less lethal option, they increased the overall frequency and severity of interventions, and in doing so, destroyed the goal of harm reduction.
They optimized for weapon diversification and shattered the objective of peaceful resolution.
It's just a perfect example of why systems thinking is so vital. You can't just incentivize one intermediate step without realizing it changes the entire environment for every other variable in the system.
And if policing is a dark example, education is probably the most widespread.
Oh, absolutely. There's no system in modern life that's been more thoroughly hollowed out by metrics than the American school system after programs that tied funding to standardized test scores.
The goal was better education. the metric became better scores, and sure enough, scores went up.
But according to countless teachers, people like Sandra Williams, the actual quality of thinking and education, it just cratered. The resource triage was brutal.
So what gets cut first?
The non-tested subjects. Art, music, recess, social studies. Why? Because they don't contribute to the metric.
So schools stopped teaching broad curiosity and civic engagement and started teaching test-taking strategies.
Students mastered the bubble sheet, but then they lost the capacity to apply that knowledge to a new problem, you know, outside the test format.
Which created this bizarre trap for teachers.
Yes. They knew the process was destructive, but if they prioritized curiosity over compliance, they risked losing funding for their school. They have to teach to the test to secure the metric, even as they watch the core goal of developing capable citizens just erode.
And you just can't measure the most important educational goals: resilience, creativity, moral imagination. You can't do it with a multiple choice test.
Let's look at healthcare, where this metric game becomes a kind of systemic shell game.
Okay.
Medicare established penalties for hospitals with high readmission rates. The assumption was if a patient returns within 30 days, the initial care must have been inadequate.
Which, again, sounds like a rational metric. It's intended to drive up quality.
But the hospitals, terrified of these huge financial penalties, they adapted their behavior, not by improving care,
but by redefining reality.
Exactly. This is where you have to understand the mechanism. When patients came back with concerning symptoms, hospitals started putting them into something called observation status instead of admitting them.
Ah, the definitional trick. Observation status is technically an outpatient designation, even if the patient is in a bed for 48 hours.
Right, and since the patient was never formally admitted in the first place, they could not technically be readmitted within 30 days.
So they successfully gamed the metric. The measured readmission rates drop, the penalties vanish.
But the care itself didn't get any better.
And I guess it was worse for patients.
Way worse. Observation status is covered differently by insurance. So patients suddenly found themselves facing these massive, unexpected out-of-pocket bills.
Wow.
Plus, it incentivized the hospital to discharge them prematurely once that observation period ended, often leading to worse health outcomes at home, just to avoid triggering the admission and that potential penalty clock.
It's a perfect encapsulation of systemic dishonesty.
It is. Dr. Lisa Patel noted that from an administrator's view, sticking to the metric is objective and defensible. If a doctor uses messy, qualitative clinical judgment and something goes wrong, they're vulnerable.
To lawsuits, to review boards.
But if they stick to the quantifiable metric, they're protected, even if they know the patient is suffering because of it.
The whole system incentivizes avoiding vulnerability over the patient's actual well-being.
So we've covered the Soviet past, the high-tech present, the systemic corruption of major institutions. The big question is, why do we keep falling into this trap? Why do we keep losing systems thinking?
Well, if we synthesize the insights from the sources, especially work on complex systems, you can really see three interlocking root causes that drive this failure.
Okay, start with how we think.
Root cause number one. We think linearly. Complex systems are nonlinear. They have feedback loops, time delays, emergent properties. When we introduce a metric, we assume A causes B.
Right.
We don't realize that A actually causes C, which causes a systemic collapse 5 years later, which then, ironically, makes B worse. We fail to anticipate the rational and self-interested response of the factory manager or the hospital administrator.
We always forget that the system being measured is alive. It's adaptive.
Exactly. The second cause is measurement bias. We've developed this institutional obsession with quantification. We only value what we can easily measure.
And we dismiss anything that isn't data.
Right. Things like wisdom, context, resilience, meaning.
If you can't put it in a quarterly report, it must not matter.
And that leads to this profound tragedy of missing what's essential. We manage what we measure. And if we can't measure quality education or soil health, we just pretend those things aren't the primary goals, and that results in systemic decay.
And the third root cause ties it all together.
Short time horizons. Metrics give us immediate, short-term feedback. Quarterly reports are clean, they're fast. We optimize for that quick feedback loop, and we entirely ignore the long-term systemic consequences that take 5, 10, 50 years to show up.
And this contrast between short-term metrics and long-term wisdom is just perfectly illustrated when we look outside these modern quantified systems.
To something like traditional ecological knowledge.
Exactly. Dr. Lakshmi Faravajwaj's research explores this. Traditional systems, whether it was farming or resource management, they didn't rely on metrics. They relied on long-term observation, direct perception, and embodied knowledge.
So a traditional farmer doesn't measure the nitrogen-phosphorus-potassium ratio with a quick test. They judge soil health by its smell, its feel, the insects they see, and decades of generational observation.
They're optimizing for the stability and resilience of the whole ecosystem.
Whereas modern industrial agriculture optimizes for a single metric, maximum yield. And it works, you know, in the short term.
But by ignoring the unmeasurable qualities of the soil biome and biodiversity, that optimized yield degrades the soil's health and often destroys the entire resource base within a few decades.
So traditional knowledge, it can't be standardized or automated, but it preserves the whole system. Modern metrics scale beautifully, but they sacrifice longevity and resilience.
Which brings us back to that famous absurd case that just sums up this whole failure mode, the cobra effect.
Where the bounty for dead cobras led to the systematic breeding of snakes.
And made the initial problem so much worse. The core lesson is always the same. Optimization of the metric always destroys the system.
The warning is clear. Systems built solely around quantifiable targets will inevitably collapse from their own internal contradictions. You can only sustain the illusion of quality for so long before the underlying structure just fails.
And the solution requires a radical change.
It does. Trusting expert judgment, extending time horizons, acknowledging the importance of non-quantifiable values.
Which is difficult, if not impossible, to implement in the current standardized structures we all operate in. So what does this all mean for you, the listener, who's navigating a world run by key performance indicators?
I think the power isn't in fixing the macro systems, which can feel immutable. The power is in your own refusal to comply with destructive metrics.
Think back to that teacher, Sandra Williams. She had to teach to the test to keep her school funded, but she found the cracks in the system. 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there. She would answer a genuinely curious question. She would prioritize a spontaneous discussion and slip in that real education, that critical thinking.
She was preserving the actual goal of teaching, even while she was superficially adhering to the broken metric of testing.
So can you do that in your own job? Can you identify the destructive metric, the one that rewards that Dana-like behavior of appearing busy but actually getting worse, and find small subversive ways to protect the real quality of your work? Resist the temptation to outsource your judgment to the number just because it's easy and defensible. The system rewards optimization, but true value, that requires resisting the score.